And now to tonight. I'm delighted to welcome Jeremy Treglown, Chair of the Warwick Writers' Programme, and novelist Alan Hollinghurst.
We're going to do a tap dance in a minute. This especially heightened floor for you. It's a great pleasure to welcome Alan Hollinghurst back to Warwick. It's at least his second visit, I think. It's a particular pleasure for me because he's a very, very old friend. I first got to know him, I suppose, around the time that he finished his graduate work. And I remember, who could forget, the announcement in the official announcement in the Oxford University Gazette, which said that Mr. Alan Hollinghurst, Magdalen College, having submitted a thesis for the degree of Bachelor of Letters on the subject of homosexuality in the work of E.M. Forster and Ronald Fairbank, would be orally examined on such and such a day. Well, after that oral examination, he went on to write, as you know, three of the most influential and powerful novels of the past decade and more, The Swimming Pool Library, The Folding Star, and most recently, The Spell. He's been described, rightly, as one of the leading gay writers in Britain, indeed in the Anglophone world. I think of him more broadly as somebody who writes more acutely, more movingly, more alertly than anybody else I can think of about the centrality and power of sexual love in people's lives, and also about its links and lack of links with other kinds of love, love of architecture, love of music, love of landscape, love of a certain kind of old-fashioned Englishness. All of those communicating themselves or being communicated in a style of incomparable elegance and attentiveness. He's going to read to us this evening. Then there'll be an opportunity to ask him questions and to have a conversation with him. Then to buy copies of his books and to get him to sign them. So please, again, welcome Alan Hollinghurst.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. It was foolish of me not to prepare some embarrassing anecdote about you for this occasion. I'm doing something else foolish, which is suddenly changing my decision of the passage I'm going to read at the last moment, which means that I'm not totally sure of what I need to say about it. This book, The Spell, is about four men. And I'll tell you who they are, because they all come together in this penultimate scene of the book. One of them is an architect in his late 40s called Robin Woodfield, who lives in Dorset, and he's tried to make an idyllic life there with a former lover who died of AIDS. In the last days of this lover's life, he falls in with a new man called Justin, who pretends to have tried to be an actor. It's not clear that he's ever actually had an audition. He drags him down to his exquisite cottage in Dorset and tries to lead an idyllic rural life with him after the first lover's death. Well, Justin's really very little interested in a life of this kind. Chafes very much at the constraints of being so far away from London and all the opportunities that it offers. At the beginning of the novel, Justin's former lover, Alex, has gone down to visit Robin and Justin at the cottage. It's the first time that Justin and Alex have seen each other for about a year. And Alex is, in a way, an improbable partner for Justin in the first place. He was very tall, shy, rather introspective, opera-loving. He goes down with very mixed feelings for this reunion. But when he's there, he meets a young man who he hasn't anticipated meeting at all, who is Robin's 22-year-old son, Danny, by a brief early marriage to a woman called Jane, who is in the present of the story, which is sort of 2 or 3 years ago, an influential academic on the west coast of America. Alex and Danny have an affair, and Danny lifts Alex out of the depression into which he'd settled after being ditched by Justin, and introduces him to a whole new world of pleasure, in which drugs play a very significant part. And Danny himself is a sort of darling or mascot of the London gay scene, and is always in and out of clubs and knows everybody and is sort of cute and profoundly unreliable. He's gone away to join at the end of the novel after all sorts of changes and tribulations. He's gone down to join his father and Justin at the cottage in Dorset, really to get away from Alex for a few days. But Alex annoyingly insists on coming down for the weekend. And Danny decides that this is the will be the time at which he's got to tell Alex that sadly the affair is over. Alex is deeply in love with Danny, but Danny's affection for him has, I think, never been more than a rather superficial thing. Each chapter of the novel is seen from the point of view of a different character. And this allows one to do rather interesting and amusing things, I think, with viewing other people's emotions in a rather detached or heartless way. And this chapter of the breakup, which at first I thought should be seen from Alex's point of view, because that would be the most sort of poignant and evolving, is rather perversely seen from Danny's point of view. They're just off in this passage I'm going to read from near the end of the novel to have drinks with a ghastly old couple who live in this little village in Dorset, called Mike and Marjorie Hall. They're terrific drunks, and most of the people in the village have shunned Robin and the little sort of gay world of his cottage and his friends, apart from the Halls. And they, as they've been banned from the local pub, they go around to the Halls the whole time to drink bottles and bottles of whiskey and gin. And when they're there, they know they're going to meet the only other homosexual in the village, a retired schoolmaster called Adrian Ringrose. And as you see, Justin has a way of altering the names of the other characters, which will make it even more confusing for you. The thing about Ada Ringrode, said Justin, is that Mike can't stand him, but Marge is being stubbornly nice to him. She asks him round almost daily, the old fag hag. Last time we were there, Mike called him a deviant of the worst kind. How did you take that? Asked Alex. Well, he was pissed, and we all laughed like lunatics, and he seemed to get the idea. Danny had just come down from a shower and was buttoning his shirt and holding his own gaze in the sitting room mirror with a sense of readying himself for a testing premiere. What does he do? He said. He saw Justin come up behind him, felt him too as he slid a hand around him with a kind of sexiness that was somehow made possible by Alex's presence, as if nothing could come of it. I believe he used to be a schoolmaster, darling. Justin peered into the mirror. One can see him being pretty eager with the slipper. He wears a bow tie, which is a well-known sign of penile inadequacy. I wasn't actually thinking of him as a sexual partner, said Danny, gently freeing himself. He has those schoolmaster shoes, like vulcanized Cornish pasties. Robin came into the room and slipped an arm round Justin in his turn. Justin glanced at his trousers and said, that's better. And Danny knew he must have asked him to change. A little power shift had happened at the price of their new togetherness. His father had been lightly pussy-whipped, or body-whipped, perhaps was the word, and once again the two of them were hugging and groping each other. He wondered for a second, in a spirit of fairness, if some new contract could save his affair with Alex, but he saw how unalike the situations were. He didn't need Alex. Justin said, I should warn you, he's very keen on the church. He plays the organ, and as you know, Mike has a blood feud with the church. Adrian's already very thick with the bishops. I mean, the people called bishop, he explained to Alex. Danny said, you seem a bit obsessed with this chappy. Justin turned back to the mirror with a pout. In village life, darling, one seizes on what interest one can. Yeah, right, said Danny, who knows about various kinds of interest that Justin has been seizing on. Alex got up and crossed the room to put a hand on Danny's shoulder. It was a friendly gesture that had gone stiff with premeditation. It looked as if he was trying to restrain him. The four of them set out through the village, sometimes like a gang across the road, then pairing up in different ways when a car came through or a bouncing, unharnessed tractor. Danny noticed the self-consciousness of the others. He thought of himself as a free person, threatened by the muddled commitments of this group of older men. When his mobile rang, he answered it with a yell and dawdled obliquely across the road for privacy. It took a moment to work out that it was Heinrich, the barman, his boyfriend for a good 10 days in the spring. He was clearly some way off his face and was talking without his usual courteous preambles and connections. "So, I want you to come across," he said. "I can't come across, darling, I'm in Dorset." After a while, Heinrich said, "Oh, my God," as though he was the last to hear of something outrageous. "You know, I'm thinking about you quite intensely. Are you by yourself?" "Yes, I've taken an ecstasy by mistake, because I have a headache. So as you can imagine, I'm feeling very great indeed, but I have no one with me, and still I have a headache. Quite soon I will go to work. Are you working at the drop tonight?" "Yes, of course." "I wish I was there," said Danny, with a childish groan of frustration. He pictured Heinrich's hairy legs, big, friendly backside. "Maybe we can have sex by the phone," Heinrich suggested. "Yeah, I can't," said Danny, pushing his other hand into his pocket. "We're just going out to drinks. We're in the street." He could do it as a dare, but he knew he would laugh too much. "So who are you with just now?" Danny looked at them across the road. In a moment's alienated vision of them was another set of people who had nothing in common. Robin with his sportsman's stroll, and Alex anxiously slowing his angled stride, and Justin, who had small feet, somehow hurrying between them. "Oh, with my dad and some friends." He raised his voice and smiled at them to confirm their suspicion he was talking about them. "Of course you will say this is because I am drug-fucked," said Heinrich, showing a German sense of extenuation nonetheless. "But you know what I think about you. You know to me, well, you are the best." Danny saw his friend again, with exact sexual recall, in the mirrored brilliance and blackness of London bars and clubs, and felt an aggravated regret for the night they would not be sharing there, the habitual regret of the pleasure lover, but shaded with a darker discontent by the sense of something needlessly thrown aside, out of fear, perhaps, though the reasons were mysterious. He had slipped away from Heinrich in an amiable absence of will, like a dreaming passenger on a slowly departing train. He said, "I'll ring as soon as I get back," and ended the call. "Who was that, darling?" said Alex. "Yes, who was it?" said Justin. "They've got you quite pink." Robin smiled at him encouragingly, confident it was some other lover seizing his chance. And Danny sensed that his father's acceptance of him, which was so much clearer than 2 months ago, was easier if he was uncommitted. As they approached the halls, the church clock struck six, and Justin said, "Listen to that, the collective whoosh of tonic water from every middle-class home in the land." But after only a few seconds of this imaginary susurration, they heard instead the charmless preparatory tolling of the bells being raised. "I'm afraid we're in for some campanology," Alex said. "That will make Mike hopping mad," said Justin. In the lane beyond the church there was Lostwithiel, formerly the rectory, then the frivolously pretty Ambages, which Justin said would turn anyone queer who lived in it. That is indeed where the new arrival in the village lives. But then Mike and Marjorie's apparently nameless house, which he proposed should be called Gordon's. Lostwithiel, which looked semi-derelict, was the home of the senile but beautifully spoken Miss Lawrence, who wandered in the village and forgot where she lived. She had been burgled over and over, and though nothing had been proved, Terry Badgett, the local hustler, was still thought to have been involved. Her old, untended damson tree dropped small, copious fruit across the path, where it fizzed with wasps, and people messed their shoes with it, and it gave off a sharp, stale smell. They had to wait a minute at the hall's front door. Danny noticed how the area around the Yale lock was scoured by innumerable rough attempts at getting the key into it. When Marjorie opened, she said in her melancholy way, "Sorry, they're watching the cricket." Justin jumped at her and hugged her, in the style that he called bringing the West End to the West Country. Robin greeted her with the usual bungled chivalry of a second kiss. Danny watched Alex shake her hand and thought how exasperatingly formal he was. In the sitting room, Mike Hall and Adrian Ringrose were standing watching the television, as if they knew it should be switched off and were abetting each other in deferring the moment. Marjorie introduced Alex and Danny over the commentary on a dubious dismissal. Then Mike snapped the telly off. "Crawley and Knight are doing well," he said. Alex said to Adrian, "Are you interested in cricket?" And he replied in a mild but precise tone, No, not at all. Danny sat down in a high-backed armchair with Alex beside him, but hidden from view by the wings of the chair. He didn't want to cuddle up to him or to be catching his eye all the time. Already, in the hall, Alex's hand had rested on his shoulder again, as if for guidance around the obstacles of the evening, and then trailed down secretively to touch his bum. He had wriggled away, but felt the presence of his rebuff, like a bruise in the air behind him. He was saying his words in his head, repeatedly, and with exaggerated confidence. He wanted the business done with fast-moving dignity, and to his own credit. It was important not to miscue it, or be hurried into it on a wave of irritation. "I love you very much, but you know I can't go on seeing you." It steadied, became reasonable, and at the same time, like anything repeated, began to sound like nonsense. Robin was saying, "Yes, Dan is my son, and Alex is, well, originally a great friend of Justin's." "I see," said Adrian, with a delayed flicker as he stored this information, though without, presumably, the hint that Danny heard of the family closing ranks. "I hadn't thought of you as old enough to have a grown-up son," he went on, in a dryly fruity way. "You're very kind," said Robin, tumbling into a low armchair. "Oddly enough, if you lose your hair before 50, people tend to think you're younger." "It's the hormones," Justin explained, like the owner, or perhaps the trainer, of a thoroughbred. Adrian himself had crinkly, old-fashioned hair, very dark for a man in his 60s. Danny's lazily accurate senses failed to detect in him whatever it was that might make them friends, a capacity for abandon, perhaps. He gave him a preoccupied smile and looked round the room, waiting to be amused. If his senses picked up sex, Danny could talk a functional kind of drivel. But in a situation like this, he felt it was weak or dishonest to show an interest he didn't feel. Maybe it was just the tension of tonight, but he wondered for a sober half-minute what the fuck he was doing in this dreary room, with its worn floral carpet and crocheted cushion covers, and the various bits of short-tempered wiring that Mike had rigged up. His father said you had to get drunk here to numb the aesthetic nerve. The few pictures of Highland cattle and Spanish dancers, though, as Justin pointed out, never the two together, showed a kind of hostility to art. Mike had gone out to get some ice and came back in a stinging shimmer of eau de cologne, perhaps having sniffed himself in the kitchen. Danny remembered the fragrance from earlier occasions and pictured him shaking it all over, like vinegar onto chips. Last time, the drinks themselves had been faintly scented from where Mike had handled the ice. They were all taking their first two sips as the church bells broke loose in a plunging peal. Marjorie set down her drink as if it cost £1,000 and went to close the windows. "This is a disadvantage of village life," she said to Adrian. Mike said, "They're bloody bastards." Adrian gave a deprecating smile and said, "Oh, it's a fine sound if it's well done." "They come from Salisbury," said Mike, "or Southampton, deliberately, to ring the bells. Now we shall have to shout all evening." Clearly Marjorie thought this would be nothing new. "I suppose it is rather a fine sound," she said. Danny could tell he was going to get drunk. He seemed instantly to have swallowed half of his tall scotch and ginger ale. He thought of Heinrich again, and the striking fact of his having rung this evening, before going off to the all-night scrum of the drop, where, doubtless at some point, a wide-eyed Spanish boy or French boy would lure him out to the corridor at the back. There was Heinrich himself, who was taking on new definition as a neglected suitor. And there was the world where Heinrich earned his living, where hundreds of men were forever catching his eye and poking money at him, and Danny felt jealous of both. "Of course I love you, Alex, but we're not meant to be together. You know as well as I do, we have nothing in common." He swayed his head to the bells, which seemed for a moment to be improvising on Madonna's bedtime story and its recurrent good idea, "Let's get unconscious, honey." Adrian said, "I don't need to tell you that Lytton Gambrill has the oldest peal of 8 bells in the county." "Is that right?" said Mike, none too pleased to be lectured on the matter by someone who'd only been in the county 5 minutes. Marjorie smiled graciously. "Do you peel yourself?" she asked, with a tiny throat clearing to bridge her doubt about the verb. Adrian's long fingers smoothed and balanced his bow tie. "I used to ring. I rang for Cambridge, but I fear of tendonitis made me something of a liability in the chamber later on." "Well, I ran for Cambridge," said Mike, in one of his mordant asides. "No bloody G. I think tonight we may hear a full grandsire major." The noise was muffled in the room, but still all pervasive, and Danny found himself listening to the dense sonic aura of the overtones, which seemed like some acoustic perception you might have in the trance of an E. Though the hypnotic thing was the evolving eight-note phrase, which imposed itself on the conversation and broke up your thoughts. Adrian, who had rapidly reverted to schoolmaster mode, was explaining some niceties of change ringing to Justin. So the conductor, as he's known, calls out Bob at the lead ends to produce a new row from which further changes can then be rung. What, Bob? Marjorie tried it distantly, as though recalling someone she'd once been fond of. She looked into her drink. I suppose there must be dozens of changes. Adrian simpered for a second or two. Well, with eight bells, the number of possible changes would be factorial eight. That's 8 times 7 times 6 times, Robin said. There was a pause for thought. Justin said, so if they rang the full grandmother's footsteps, it would be over 4 million changes. Fucking hell, muttered Mike and emptied his glass. No, no, said Adrian with a bright, nervous giggle, but it'd be well over 40,000, obviously. Well, they'd better not do well over 40,000 tonight, Mike said, getting up and standing over Adrian while he gulped down the rest of his drink. Alex was very quiet. Danny wondered if he knew what was coming. He probably did. He was very sensitive. And he'd been through this kind of thing before. Danny looked casually at Justin, whom he found alien in many ways, and saw that they were about to share the shabby distinction of having thrown Alex over. He knew from his breakup with George what the pain might be like, and he noticed that, having been through it himself, he felt somehow authorized and even empowered to inflict it on someone else. It was the hard currency of human business. Slightly giddy from his own philosophy, he reached up to take his second cold drink. Adrian said, I do think we're so lucky in having this marvellous castle in the village. He had the surprised talkativeness of a buttoned-up person abruptly filled with alcohol. I hadn't realised just how lucky we were, murmured Marjorie. There's not much to the castle, is there? Said Justin doubtfully. My darling Justin has never actually seen the castle, said Robin, with a funny gloving of his jibe. But he's only lived here a year. No, 10 months, actually, sweetie, and 3 days, Justin said. Anyway, I never thought it wise to go down Ruins Lane. Adrian, who was disconcerted by a joke, said, I found poor Miss Lawrence wandering up there yesterday. She had no idea where she was going. There you are, said Justin. She needs taking care of, said Mike, with a certain softening of tone. What are the so-called fucking social services doing? She's as mad as a house, said Justin. Did I tell you I saw her talking to a beetle? Danny smirked and drew a finger through the wet on his glass. Mike said to him, You're very quiet tonight, young fellow, my lad. He's always quiet, said Marjorie. It's nice. Justin said, It's the country air that tires him out. He's not used to all this oxygen, are you, darling? He normally goes round in a cloud of LSD, don't you, darling? I don't think you smoke LSD, said Adrian. No, you don't, said Alex. I'm sure Danny doesn't anyway, said Marjorie. Adrian said with the casualness of the shockable, Do you see anything of all this drugs business up in London? Danny felt it would be absurd to lie. Oh, yeah, he said warmly. He could be nice to them, he guessed, but he hated the silly compromises that were forced on you when you entered the remote moral atmosphere of closety old bores. As he didn't say anything else, Adrian nodded and coloured and said, You do, yes. Yes, thought Danny in a spasm of frustration and worry. I can get in free to any club in London and get off my face for days on end and have anyone there I want. Yes, I saw a lot of it in South America, of course. It was cocaine everywhere, which I believe cost almost nothing. I must say I was never tempted to try it. Really, said Alex, who was leaning forward to catch Danny's eye. I didn't know you'd been in South America, said Mike, irritated by this claim on his curiosity. Whereabouts? Oh, very much so. I was with the British Council in Caracas and then in Lima for 4 years. This was in the late '50s, after Cambridge. After your ringing years. Yes. But they used to say they were all flower arrangers in the British Council, said Mike. Adrian looked down for a moment to give this remark time to clear and went on, I've got some very lovely folk art that I brought back, some of which you'll see when you come to Ambergers. I have a beautiful Peruvian hanging in my bedroom. The words themselves hung in the air, lightly and evenly stressed against the background clamour of the bells, and it was Marjorie who started to laugh first, an almost noiseless, polite snuffle. And then a cackle came from Justin. Danny heard the chug-chug of Alex's laugh, and then he got it himself through the glaze of his preoccupation and started to giggle breathlessly with an edge of hysterical relief before Mike gave out his rarely heard whimper. It was never quite clear whether Adrian had seen the joke. The amusement was too general for him to go against it, and he sat smiling bashfully, looking sideways at the floor. After a while, Marjorie struggled to make a long face and said, "Adrian, I'm so sorry," with the insincere regret that follows a burst of instinct. Embarrassed and obliged to show willing, Adrian said, "Well, Danny, perhaps you should go to South America. People sniff cocaine in Lima like you and I drink sherry." Danny nodded with another after-tremor of laughter. "Yeah, that might be good." He looked away. "Actually, I'm going back to the States next month. I think that's more the sort of place for me." When he looked up again, Justin was making a "get her" face. Robin said with a tender frown, "First I've heard of it." Alex, of course, he couldn't see, only the convulsion of his legs uncrossing and crossing the other way. "You're going to your mother's?" Robin mastered the situation. "Yeah, I think so," said Danny. "She says she can always get me a job out there again." "And where is that?" said Adrian. "San Diego." "No, I don't imagine I'll ever fly again," said Mike, loudly and slowly, as though that were the really interesting aspect of the matter. Danny saw Justin looking gently in Alex's direction. To the others, of course, this sudden birthing of a plan was neither here nor there. He said, surprised by his own note of involuntary bitterness, "Well, there's not much to keep me in this country." When you had an audience, you could say things easily that were almost impossible to bring out one-to-one, even in bed. Though perhaps it was also easy to say too much. Mike said, "I suppose we could hang each bell ringer from his individual rope." "I'm getting quite used to it," said Marjorie. "I think we'll all rather miss it when it stops." Then, seeing Alex had got up and was going towards the door, she said, "It's across the hall and turn left." He blinked and went out. The conversation ambled on, given sly prods and perverse turns by Justin, who seemed to feel responsible for the success of the occasion in a way that he never did at home. Mike was wincing at the wall, too caught up in the smoulder of his outrage to make his usual polemical sallies. Danny had the childish sensation of being ignored and unvalued after his clumsy moment in the spotlight. He couldn't think about how cruel he had just been to Alex, and when he tried to run through his resignation speech again, it had a horrible, echoless deadness to it, like something said in a recording studio. He looked along the faces of the others, wondering what they were talking about. His father's expression was especially husbandly and benign. Then Danny found Justin was staring privately at him, and he knew he was right when he twitched his head towards the door. "I must just go too," Danny said under his breath as he slipped out. The lavatory door was shut, and he waited for a minute outside, suddenly fidgety for a pee himself. Then he thought, "Well, he's still my boyfriend," and tapped and went in. But Alex wasn't there. In the white emptiness of the stuffy little room, Danny knew the crisis had closed in on him. As he peed, he looked sideways into the mirror and saw how terribly beautiful he was. The image itself was reflected again off some hard, vain surface deep in his eye. He thought, with easy pity, how little Alex would want to lose him. On the narrow shelf above the basin was a thinning hairbrush and a comb and a square bottle of cologne. He pulled out the stopper to confirm it was the one they had been breathing all evening and turned down his mouth in the mirror when he saw that it was called bien-être. Alex was sitting on the back doorstep looking down the sloping, untidy garden. Danny came through the kitchen and sat beside him, but without touching him. Alex said, "Oh, Dan." It was very rare for him to call him by name. "I'm sorry," Danny said. He thought perhaps by some miracle Alex had understood everything. "I really do think you might have told me about this U.S. thing." "Yeah, you terrify me at times." Alex reached for his hand, and he let him hold it, but without any return of pressure. "I mean, what happens to us? I can come and see you, of course. I look forward to that, but it's hardly very convenient." "Well, or perhaps you're not really going," Alex went on, in a tetchily forgiving tone. "But if you are, it would have been nice not to have heard it announced in the middle of a drinks party." They had never had a row, merely separate hurts and irritations which they had seduced each other out of. Danny saw that he hadn't done this right, and it made him sulkily aggressive. "I may not go," he said, and withdrew his hand. "I mean, I'm your boyfriend, a lanky bloke whose arms around you when you wake up and who then goes off to make your breakfast. That's me." "Yeah, I wondered who it was," said Danny. "Look, it doesn't really matter whether I'm here or in San Diego. I can't go on seeing you, Alex." Alex had already drawn the breath that should have carried his next remark, but he halted and let it out in a tragic sigh. Danny stood up and strolled back across the kitchen and drew a glass of water. The whiskey was giving him a slight headache, rather like poor Heinrich. "I'm very sorry," he said. When he glanced round, Alex was sitting in the same place, but tipped sideways against the door frame, as though he'd been thrown there by a blast. The pose was somehow histrionic and got on Danny's nerves. He saw him roll his head once, quickly, to see where he was. Danny had the feeling that he himself had become the embodiment of something dreaded that could hardly be looked at. Back in the sitting room, he was told to help himself to another drink. He knew he'd been sobered up by the adrenaline of the past 5 minutes, and unexpectedly humiliated by Alex snapping at him to leave him alone. The others all seemed pathetically drunk and old. Adrian was asking about ladies that did. Various village names were rummaged for, each followed by a horrifying cautionary anecdote. "We've never had any fucking charwoman," said Mike, which nobody pretended to be surprised by. Justin said, "You can always have nude housework done, of course." Adrian pursed his lips, but would clearly have liked to know more. Mike said in a marvelling monotone, "You lot talk so much fucking tripe." "I'm not against nude housework," said Marjorie, "but I think I'd have to go out while it was being done." "Where's the silent Scotsman?" said Mike. "Polishing his nails?" Danny studied their five faces again. They all had a foolish look of temporary confidence, which he forgot he must often have had himself, in extremer forms too. Even Mike, who got furious on drink, seemed to have entered into a richer and more evolving relation with himself. "Alex is just getting a bit of air," Danny said, for which Mike nodded and drummed his fingers on his knee. Both he and Marjorie had renounced cigarettes, and the peculiar ashtrays mounted on stirruped thongs had gone from the arms of the sofa, but still the magnolia paintwork was dimly varnished with smoke and gave the room an atmosphere of terminated pleasures. Perhaps the others didn't care or were too sozzled to notice the room filling with shadows, but Danny never lost his sense of the speed of time. When he thought of Alex's epic hesitations, the years without sex, the unaccountable solitariness, it brought him close to a panic of impatience. He saw that Justin was peering at him again, with a hint of a smile. He couldn't work out the ironies in it. It seemed encouraging and disappointed at the same time, as well as secretively sexual, as if they already had an agreement to meet up later. He knew he had just done something serious and needed assurance that he'd been right. Then the bells came tumbling down the scale and stopped. The overtones swam there for a moment, and after that the ear was haunted by the bells and heard them fadingly continuing. The silence was astonishing, being ordinary existence thrown into relief by the hour or more of incessant sound, unwavering in rhythm and volume. And then it wasn't silence. Mike got up and pushed the windows open, and there was a bird twittering, a car whining as it reversed, the dry runs of an old-fashioned mower, like a child's rattle. Alex was somewhere outside in the wilderness of the garden. Danny had been sent in, but he guessed he would have to go back out to him. Mike sped across the room with the brawler's roll he had when drunk. "Right," he said, switching on the old blue leather Philips gramophone, which he had confidently attached to an even older-looking valve amplifier and huge speakers. "I think they've cut it rather short," said Adrian unwisely. "Don't get me wrong, Ringrose," said Mike over his shoulder, "but your bell-ringing pals are fucking cunts." "Oh, dear," said Marjorie. "I'm afraid so," said Mike, exhilarated to have reached this stage of the evening already. "I'm just going to check on Alex," Danny said. He was in the kitchen when he heard the music start, and then it came out very clearly through the windows when he stepped into the garden. It was Mike's retaliation against the bells, a crackly old record of Gregorian chant, turned up offensively loud, though the music itself remained more than unflappable. The spare and echoing rise and fall of men's voices, the ritual Latin. Danny stood for a moment by the two deck chairs on the rough circle of lawn and thought of calling to Alex, like someone getting a child in for a meal or bed. But he saw that the tone would be wrong. He was annoyed with Alex for still being here. Then a second later, he was a little frightened at his responsibility. He stooped past the woody bud layer and down a path under apple trees. There was a shed and a fruit cage covered in convolvulus and one weedy but cultivated patch of kitchen garden. After that, the lot tapered and there was only wild grass thigh-deep and a big old tree at the bottom where the fences met. He saw Alex perched on the fence with his back against the tree trunk, looking unapproachably lonely. You could still see the curving track he had made through the grass. Danny, after some barely conscious symbolic scruple, made a separate wading path towards him. The grass was dry and bleaching from the mid-August heat, and where Danny's hands trailed into it, they found it dusty and sometimes sticky with secretions like bubbled spit. Underfoot there was a crackling, and he realized he was treading on tiny grey snails, and there were dozens of them clinging like seed cases on the thicker stalks. By the time he came to stand at Alex's shoulder, his baggy black jeans were streaked and powdered from the field. He thought Alex might be crying, and that he'd been sent away so as not to witness that. But when he peered at him sidelong, there was no sign of it. "I've come to see how you are," he said. After a while, Alex said, "It's like fucking murder in the cathedral." "The music, you mean," said Danny, with a snigger. Then Alex went on, very tensely, as if afraid of anything Danny might say. "You remember we walked up there not long ago?" He swept his hand up quickly to hide its shaking. Danny detected some sentimental reproach. "Yes, of course, it was a beautiful evening," he said. Though he did find it striking that Alex should mention it, because that evening up on the hill had been the silent turning point for him, with Alex talking about his failure with Justin, and a sense of failure coming off him, like someone you would be unwise to set up business with. Danny said, pretty confident that it wouldn't be put to the test, "You know we'll always be friends." Alex half turned, but still didn't look directly at him. "Is it George?" he said. Danny chuckled sourly. "George wouldn't let me anywhere near him. It's not Terry, for God's sake. Alex, it's not anyone." He wanted to touch him consolingly, but also to push him off the fence, where he was nodding forward and hugging himself delicately, as if every liaison of Danny's were a broken rib or an unhealed cut. "I'm sorry," Alex said. "I can't take in anything you're saying. You seem to be talking gibberish. We're two people wildly in love with each other, and you're saying that you can't see me anymore." I've changed, darling. People change. I'm sorry." He glanced back over the full 2 months of their affair and remembered getting dressed in front of Alex on the first evening he came round, thinking he'd never seen anyone so well-mannered and so sex-starved. It had been at a strange moment in his own little affair with cynical Black Bob, and he could see now that there'd been something defiant and capricious, perhaps, about taking up with Alex. "I haven't changed at all," said Alex, "apart from coming to love you more and more." "You know, we don't have anything in common," said Danny, and had to acknowledge that it didn't sound that great. Alex shook his head. "I thought the affair itself was what we had in common," he said. "Yeah, well..." Danny stuck to his idea that there was nothing to talk about. He frowned and blinked away the muddled imagery of their nights together, the happiness and sweat. And he knew there was a dappled prospect of things he could have learned from Alex if he'd given him time and attention. But for the moment, and so perhaps forever, he needed the story to be bare and shadowless. They'd gone out and got off their faces, and Alex had had his mind open to dance music. And now they were ending up in music, something altogether more monastic, even if distantly interspersed with Mike shouting, "Cunt!" out of the window. Danny decided quickly and analytically that Alex, in spite of his wounded bafflement, accepted what had happened. There was no immediate suggestion of working out problems or a trial separation. He couldn't put it into words, but he saw something fatalistic in Alex rush forward to acknowledge the disaster. "Come on," said Danny. As they toiled out of the long grass, he gestured courteously to Alex to go ahead of him, followed a few paces behind him up the rather notional path. The chanting grew grander as they approached the house, and he knew there would be some solemn moments ahead. He quite admired the way he'd brought it off. It was the first big breakup he'd been responsible for. With an older man, there was, of course, that further question of respect. He stopped to brush and slap at the mess on his trousers. Thank you for listening, sir.
First up with a question, can't it? Who wants to go first? I'm going to repeat the question for the recording, if I may. It's a question about the importance of touch in the book.
I don't think I'd thought about it sort of as schematically as your question might require me to have done. For people, when they are drawn to each other or in love with each other, want to touch each other, and the different kinds of ways in which they touch and or are not allowed to touch, or in which the ambiguous ways in which touches are reciprocated and so on, I think is a fascinating part of the language, the physical language of love. So I guess why that, if it does have the provenance that you're suggesting, that would be why. I mean, is there something else funny about it that I haven't noticed? Certainly right, and I suppose novelists habitually use physical expressions, physical gestures to convey things which aren't conveyed in words, just as we do in life. So one tries to be accurate to furnish all occasions with those sort of those hints which physical gestures give.
I guess in a world of so many shifting relationships, as in this book, there would be a more extensive vocabulary of that kind.
Yeah, probably.
It's a complex question about the relation between comic and the tragic, and the possibility that the comic creates a complicity between the text and the reader that enables some of these qualities to be more accessible.
Yes, it is complex. I mean, I think I've always been quite attracted to the idea of writing about what you call tragic things, but certainly painful and difficult things in a comic way. And I suppose something which I've always enjoyed in the Volkov is kind of deliberate apparent heartlessness in the way he treats tender feelings, and often sees things from the point of view of the aggressor or the cheat. Or I think it probably arises from a certain anxiety about treating emotions and things which could very easily become sentimental too directly, and trying to get a different angle on them. And I hope what happens is that the emotions are released in a new way by the kind of resistance that is put up by the comic approach. I think my own attitude to life in general is very kind of tragic comic. These things always highlight each other. The times of despair, ones of oddly hilarious. It's something too deep for me quite to be able to explain. You're right that it does sort of attract me and seem an explanation of something and a way of talking about it.
I wanted to ask a question, if I could, that's related to that. I hope it doesn't precisely duplicate what you've asked. To do with the reversal that you bring about in the book over priorities to do with responsibility, if I can put it like that. You play with the word responsible in contexts where responsibility is diminished. So you talk, for example, there's that carload of sort of riotously camp people going along, and Alex is the person who he takes a responsible pleasure in the villages. And it's Alex also who, early in his affair with Danny, begins to talk responsibly about dinner. They're going out to dinner. Meanwhile, there's an assumption that that sexual passion disregards responsibility. I noticed it in actually sort of accidentally in the passage you read, when Marjorie produces the insincere regret that follows a burst of instinct. But what I was thinking about before that was two moments in the book. One is, again, to do with Alex and Dan.
And that one person who acts as, well, as a guide to the other. And I think the things I'd written before, the older person was the guide to the younger, and had, as it were, a sense of responsibility for them and what happened to them. And of course, Alex is actually a rather sort of cautious, prudential kind of person, and being much older feels those things you quoted about having to take charge of the situation. But actually, that sort of archetype is inverted, and it's the young person who becomes the guide to Alex, and he has, as it were, to surrender responsibility for himself and his actions to this boy about whom he actually knows very little. And that thing of surrendering to the spell of Danny is, in a way, itself the archetype of what the book is about, which is people sort of giving over responsibilities to themselves, to feelings or sensations, experiences over which they don't have control. I think I've always been interested in writing about appetites and impulses and behaviour as it occurs without judgment. And that's something which is much easier to do if you're writing in the first person, because you're not as a novelist obliged to adjudicate, as it were. I think it could be tremendously unfair, because it's all fueled by and expressed through the emotions and obsessions of the narrator. And you don't quite know where you are morally in such a book. It's a constantly fluctuating relationship between reader and narrator. In this book it's rather different, because it's written in the third person, but I hope that by bringing each character in turn into focus and seeing events successively from the point of view of different characters, one got some sort of prismatic sense of behaviour, of characters behaving apparently immorally or amorally, but their behaviour seeming to others to be immoral or offensive or upsetting. So the different moral values, particularly those between Justin and Danny, who are the young troublemaking characters, and Robin and Alex, constantly highlighted. And Robin and Alex both have higher moral expectations, I suppose, of both of themselves and of others than their partners do.
Thank you.
I wrote the swimming pool library in a desk diary, yes.
Would you describe the method, first of all, of writing the swimming pool library, for those who don't know?
I wrote it in a rather ridiculous way, really, which was I wrote it in a desk diary, which I'd been given, which had, was it the TLS desk diary, which had a page for each day of the year, which was 1984. And I felt I needed some imposed discipline, so I started writing it on January the 1st, and I wrote the idea being that I would write a page each day, so that I soon got out of kilter with the diary's rather exacting plan. It took me years to get to the end of it. But nonetheless, the book did precisely fill the desk diary. And it has 12 chapters, and each chapter ended on the last line of a month. So it had a precise, finite length before I began writing it, which I found quite a help and sort of allayed a lot of anxieties that I had on setting out what I knew was going to be the first book that I actually finished.
So then the question is whether you've set yourself...
After that, I don't think I really felt I had quite the need for just such precise constraints. And though I've always planned things pretty carefully before I start, they've gone on from notebook to notebook to notebook. And I do believe in plan, but not to the point of kind of inhibiting you or finding yourself bored simply. I mean, I hate the idea of just colouring in a plan which you've imagined in every detail. But I think there has to be a strong, clear framework within which you work, and within which you then make, you hope, discoveries and explorations. So the plan itself may change quite radically, but it has to be there before you start.
There seems to be some sort of
rhyme between this very fastidious organizational approach and something that goes on in the novels, in the contrast between a deep affection for and watchfulness about very formal activities like bell ringing or certain kinds of music or certain kinds of architecture, and a pleasure in emotional and sexual anarchy and extreme freedom. Mm. And this book, partly shown in Alex's giving into the world of ecstasy and house music and thinking that house music is wonderful. Another question here. Is Alan frustrated at being labelled as a gay writer and with the whole idea of labels as something which characterised this decade?
I quite agree about labels and lists, and this whole ghastly thing as we approach the millennium is getting even worse, of being rung up almost every other day to ask, being asked to contribute to the list. I was just emailed, in fact, 3 days ago by someone asking me to contribute to a list of the 100 best gay novels of the century. Actually, I don't bother to get frustrated about it. People will put labels on you. There's nothing you can do about it, so it's rather pointless to be frustrated about it. And there are aspects, of course, in which, you know, it's a meaningful classification, in that I've always written books sort of from a gay point of view and about gay characters, and I know they're of interest, I hope, to all sorts of people, but certainly to a gay readership. I mean, I think there is something much narrower called gay fiction, which is writing by gay writers, for gay writers, usually published by sort of specialised gay presses and so on, which is fine. It doesn't interest me, but I don't have an argument with that. But of course it is frustrating if people think that is the only interest in your books and that is all you're writing about. And I think I've always tried to write from the presupposition of a gay point of view without apology or explanation, you know, as naturally as a heterosexual writer would do so from a heterosexual point of view. And things are changing, of course, and there's a sense, perhaps, in which, you know, like movements like Gaylib themselves, I mean, their function shifts and may in the end be questioned. And if gay liberation achieved all its objectives, then it would be, as it were, to annihilate the distinction between, you know, the specialness of being gay. There's such an element of a protest or difference or exploration in gay literature that we've known so far, but I think that's something which will change as attitudes change, and gay experience will still be worth writing about, but I don't think it will remain a genre in the way that it has in the past. We shall see what happens. I think it's quite interesting.
Jermaine.
Can imagine it. When people say, do you think straight novelists have produced, you know, rounded, convincing gay characters, or could they? I always say, I like to think that, you know, the power and prerogatives of the imagination are such that, of course, they could, but actually, when you think about it, have they? And I must say, I don't think quite as in those terms. My stories sort of come to me mysteriously and I sort of write them, and I don't ever quite take on the challenge, as it were, of doing something like that. And of course I like to think that I could, but then I have doubts about actually whether it would be so easy.
I ask the question because women have been so written
question. Yes. I did promise to do it in my next book. I think that's quite right, and in some cases it's certainly in my first book, and in this one, that's very much part of the design of the book, that they are about people who are, as I say, afraid of commitments and in search of new sensation and sort of, in a sense, avoiding themselves. That is something which just seems to have interested me. I mean, in this new book, I've tried to offset that restlessness against a deeper desire for continuity, domestic life, solidity, loyalty, and shown these how hard it is for the characters to sort of achieve these things.
At the same time, it's rather hard to imagine a novel by you with your characters which would take the sort of Jane Austen form in which the whole book consists of the characters deciding to shack up together.
Yes.
So there's a structural consequence for your fiction.
Yes.
Of the phenomenon.
Well, this is very, is that passage obviously sort of metaphorically insists on that I read. I mean, this is very much a book about changes and about a sort of comic or sometimes it was farcical, sort of permutations between a set of characters. And that itself is a sort of, the other part of what I was saying is a sort of literary tradition and a literary device. I suppose the Jane Austen thing, the sisters will both be happily married and so on. At the end of this book, there are two sort of relationships ambiguously established. And I like that element of uncertainty and ambiguity. The end of my books is always, it's usually quite a bit of resolution of plot business just before the end, and then the last few pages sort of throw everything up in the air again, and that seems to be something which I find sort of formally satisfying, but it must also say something about sort of view of relationships that's expressed in the book.
I think we've just time for one more question, and then we will stop.
Being that amongst the gay readership.
So the proselytizing of gay values, does that militate against the imaginative value of gay fiction? Is that the
I think it may well do, and I probably don't read enough gay fiction actually to give a really accurate answer to that question. I'm certainly aware, as a writer who is gay, that there are readers or areas of the readership that want you to do certain things and who have agendas which they would like you to follow and subjects they would like you to treat, which to me is just almost an instruction to do the opposite. And I so much value, to me the point of writing is to explore kind of the imaginative constructs of my own, that the idea of having to write to the order of someone else's imaginative constructs is sort of intolerable, really. And I think there will be terrible dangers in that way, so what you say is probably true.
Well, thank you very much indeed for reading and for answering questions so interestingly. there's an opportunity now for you to ask questions personally, and also to acquire copies of these books. We've got about a quarter of an hour for that. So join me in thanking Alan Hollinghurst.